What is pollen?
Pollen is a fine powdery substance produced by plants, and they use it as part of their reproductive cycle. So it's the closest equivalent on the human body would be human sperm. So sperm cells, so these are male gametes, and they get transmitted to the female, and seeds are produced as a result of that. So that's part of the reproductive cycle. And it's fine and powdery, and it's essentially the same word as flower, F-L-O-U-R. So it's like polenta. So that's where the term comes from.
If you look at it under a microscope, what does it look like?
Well, they're quite beautiful. Some of them are absolutely stunning. So they come in various shapes and sizes because it's involved in that production of the next generation, production of seeds. There's all sorts of different shapes and forms that plants have produced on their pollen grains to allow them to be transmitted. Basically, there's two types of pollen. Now, this is speaking very broad scale, helicopter view. There are pollen grains which are transmitted by the wind. The plants use wind to carry them from plant to plant. And there are other ones which use different types of animals to do that. So birds and bees and insects and so on. The ones which use animals to transmit them from plant to plant have got all these little adaptations, all these little features on the surface so that they get caught up in fur and feathers and dander and so on. So that when a bird or a bee comes along, they get hooked on and they get carried away from the plant that produced them to the plant which has got the female parts. And pollen grains which are carried on the wind don't have that. They've got other adaptations. So they're very light. So they get carried on the wind easily and they can hang in the breeze. And sometimes they've got things like air bladders on them so they can get carried on the breeze for very long distances. So broadly speaking, those are two different types of pollen, but they've got all sorts of other things. Some come in little packets of 4, 8, 12, 16 or so. So they come in little groups of cells.
They're individual cells. And are they proteins or what?
Yeah, so they're not quite individual cells. So when we go back to that analogy of a human sperm is a single cell. Pollen grains are the cells which produce those things which are called sperm. So each pollen grain is a big cell, and inside that are one or two smaller cells. So they're cells within cells. It's a bit like Russian dolls. So the cells within cells, those two cells are the sperm cells, which are going to go on and bring about fertilization and production of the next generation.
Those people that live in places like Melbourne, they'd be familiar with grass pollen and they'd be aware that grass pollen is carried in the air.
Yep.
What is an example of something where it is carried by bees or birds?
Yeah. So along with that sort of wind pollinated versus animal pollinated difference in pollen grades, there's a whole bunch of other things which happen on the plant. So the flowers are different shapes. So flowers which are pollinated by insects have got all sorts of things to attract an insect to them. So will attract insects as a reason they come to the flower. The flowers have also got bright colors on them so that the insects see them. They're like advertising hoardings sitting out there saying, I've got sugar here. Come and visit me now. So all of that sort of stuff. And you don't need to produce very much pollen. So if you've got someone helping you out, if you've got, an insect carrying things from one plant to another, you don't need to produce all that much pollen. So they produce less pollen than a wind pollinated plant. Wind pollinated plants, it's a pure numbers game. So they just throw stuff out there in huge amounts and just on the charts that some of it will get into the right place. An insect pollinated plant, you've got a packet of pollen and you know that this insect is going to go off and visit and not the flower. So it's got a very high chance of getting to the right place.
The bee sees the color or identifies that there's some kind of treat, a bee Mars bar.
Yeah.
They land on there and then all the pollen gets stuck to their legs and then they fly off to the next convenience store.
Right. That's exactly right. So if you think about flowers, you're thinking about things which have got all those sort of bright colors and so on. That's what attracts insects and flowers. That's what attracts us to flowers as well. So though you're thinking it, beautiful daisies, a lovely bunch of roses, lilies, all that sort of things. They're all insect pollinated flowers. Those have got those characteristic look of, they produce scents, they'll produce vibrant colors, they'll often have nectar rewards and so on. That's all hallmarks of something which is pollinated by insects. If you've got a plant there which you never see it in flower, it's more than likely it's a wind pollinated plant. So wind pollinated plant, the flowers are not interested in attracting pollinators at all. So they don't have big showy flowers. They don't have nectar rewards. They're just tanins, which are the organs which produce pollen. They're just hanging out there in the breeze and dumping as much pollen as they can onto the breeze. And so the flowers tend to be what we call cryptic, very hard to discern, hard to see. And they also tend to be out on the edges of the branches.
With something like ryegrass, which lots of people are allergic to, if you looked at ryegrass, would you be able to tell when it's pollinating?
If you know what the flowers are up on the so ryegrass produces a stem and the flowers are at the tip of the stem. And when the flower is open, the anthers are hanging out there in the breeze. And there's all sorts of crude analogies for that, but I guess I'll let people draw their own pictures.
And so pollen season is really mating season?
Yeah, exactly. So it's mating season for that particular type of plant. And different plants do their mating at different times of the year. So some plants, the European trees, for example, they're flowering at the end of, or they're producing pollen at the end of winter and in the early spring period. So, and if you think about those plants, they're deciduous and they're just, they lose their leaves over winter and they're just coming back into leaf. So they usually start flowering before they produce their leaves. And then as we move through the year, we get into the grasses. The grasses are the first thing we'll see a lot of. So we'll think about early season pollen producers will be those European trees. So elms and oak, cypresses also flower that call it flowering. They're actually a coniferous plant, so they're not, don't actually have a flower. They have a cone instead, but they're producing their pollen at that time of year. And then as we get into later in spring, around October and so on, we're getting a lot of production of grass pollen. The grasses are coming along and they are the dominant flowering plant at that time of year. So lots of grasses are getting their reproduction done before the height of the summer comes along. And then as we get into the late summer, we get other things flowering and there'll be daisies and sorts of things like that will start flowering then.
I was chatting to Nick Osborne the other day and he said in Brisbane, they have 3 or 4 different pollen seasons. So you can be in one country or perhaps even in different parts of the state and experience different types of pollen explosions throughout the course of the year.
Yeah, that's right. So those seasons that I talk about, that October-November season for grass is characteristic of southern Australia, and that's to do with our latitude. As you go further north, the soils warm up quicker, temperate areas. Melbourne is a temperate area, and into subtropical areas. So in a temperate area, we've got colder winters and warmer summers. In a subtropical area, temperature tends to be a bit more even through the year, but you move into more monsoon. So we get more distinct wet and dry seas. Some plants respond to all of those sorts of different cues. And you can also think about going from bottom of the hill up to the top of a hill. So going up to up higher. So a place like Canberra is going to have very different sorts of, because it's going to be cooler, it will have different seasons to places that are at the same latitude down at the coast, on a lower altitude.
Do plants prefer to mate when it's warmer and drier?
They respond to all sorts of different things. So if you're the only thing flowering at the time and there's nothing else for the pollinators to come to, then you've got a huge advantage. So there is a great advantage to being the only thing flowering. If you're in there flowering with lots of other plants at the same time, then there's more competition for access to pollinators. So there's a real little game there, an evolutionary game, about what time of year you flower and that ability to transmit pollen from one plant to the other is a big determinant there. So access to pollinators. So some plants had faithful pollinators. They had almost exclusive relationships with pollinators. And there are some classic examples of adapted just so this particular animal, which has got a particularly long tongue, can get down to the bottom of the flower. And it's only that plant that can get pollinated by that particular insect. And then there are other ones which are more general in their use of pollinators. So just use whatever is around. So avoiding rain and sun is one thing, but also access to pollinators. But if you're a wind pollinated plant, you can flower pretty much at any time of the year, so long as it's warm enough.
And how accurately can you now predict when pollen season will start, detecting actual pollen in the air just by using atmospheric conditions and previous years and models?
Evidence of plants getting ready to flower can be viewed from space. So that's a big advance in recent years. It's all environmental conditions on the ground, such as the amount of water available and temperature and so on. But one of the things that is really useful to us is that greening up of the planet as we come out of winter and into spring. And that's a sign of plants preparing themselves for the next phase of their life, which is reproduction. We can see that from space. So images of planet from space tell us a lot about that, where plants are at with their reproductive cycle. Some plants don't go through that. So you think about your eucalypts and so on, which are evergreens. They don't change color so much, but we've got other ways of saying when they're likely to flower as well.
And as a seasoned professional in the pollen counting game, how easy is it to teach someone to look at different types of pollen under a microscope and identify birch pollen versus ryegrass pollen? But I mean, there must be thousands of different types of pollen. Yeah. How easy is it for the human eye to be able to detect the difference between the different types of trees and grasses?
It's very straightforward. It's easy enough to do. And it's one of those things that once you get a bit of a taste for it or an interest in it, you almost want to learn new things, want to learn the next pollen type and so on. So in about an hour, we can go through from the basics of pollen biology, some of which I've touched on here with you today, and get people counting and being able to identify pollen, certain types of pollen, some of the easier types of pollen, fairly readily. And I could probably give a couple of clues as to what people should look for, help people identify some different types of pollen just over the radio. So if you were looking down a microscope at some pollen grains and you saw one that looked like, you said, oh, that looked like Mickey Mouse, what you're looking at is a pine pollen. So if you see Mickey Mouse, that's pine pollen. So there we go. We've already taught people how to recognize pollen.
Yeah, so a circle with a couple of big ears. Exactly. So it's just like me. Yeah. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. They're bigger, but yeah, that's what they look like. And they're absolutely wonderful.
Right, cool.
Big air bladders, which help the pollen grain fly long distances.
Some sort of aeronautical engineering feat.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Right.
Now, the big question is, why on earth, when pollen, grass pollen, take ryegrass pollen if you're allergic to that, when that enters your mouth or your nose, why is it that some people have such an insidious reaction to it in the form of either hay fever or allergic asthma? Now, you're not a doctor and we're not giving medical advice.
Sure.
But just at a high level, what is happening when those pollen grains fly up my nose or fly into my mouth?
So we talk about people being allergic to pollen, but what people are allergic to is individual proteins that are on the pollen and which the pollen grain needs to function. So there's a range of these proteins and they're very soluble. So pollen grains are fit. Pollen is flour, F-L-O-U-R, it's dry, and it gets moisture. Living things have moisture in them. Living things are wet, and pollen grains being dry initially, and they obtain wetness in nature from the female tissues, from the place where it lands to cause reproduction. And when it lands inside the human body, up the nose, in the eyes and so on, in the mouth, it gets moisture from us. And that it starts to release protein because it's preparing for reproduction. Unfortunately, we're not where it meant to be. We're a wrong thing, but the human body perceives them as being an invading pathogen and amounts an immune defense against the pollen grain, even though it's benign. There's a lot of it there that could easily be some sort of a virus or a bacteria or so. So it's an adaptation or an immune response that people have, which is inappropriate because it's not defending the body against an invading organism. So one of the sort of interesting things is that aspirin, hay fever are more prevalent in developed industrialized countries. And people talk about the hygiene hypothesis. That is that as we've made our environment cleaner and tidier and have fewer interactions with the natural world, we've removed an important filter for the body. We're no longer exposing ourselves to all sorts of different organisms, and the body is choosing which ones to concentrate on and which ones to ignore. So when we get things that are benign, certain food types, pollen grains, and so on, the body is mounting an inappropriate immune response to those benign things. And that's as a consequence of our lifestyle that allergens, hay fever, asthma, and so on.
You could draw a similar conclusion to someone who's allergic to peanuts. They eat the peanut gets broken down in their bodies. The proteins from the peanut are released and their body says, you know, we don't like you and we're going to fight you off. And that could cause an anaphylactic reaction or hives or some other type of reaction. Mm. You're one of the doyens of pollen, pollen counting and pollen forecasts. Mm-hmm. You must get asked all the time, what are the things that people can do and what are the tools that people can access to help them firstly understand what types of pollen they may have allergic reactions to and what is the best way to avoid exposure to those types of pollen?
Most people are going to develop their allergies in their early years, in their childhood years or in their teenage years. And so it's something that your parents are going to be aware of, and they'll help you with those first identifications of what you're allergic to. So if you're developing asthma or hay fever during your teenage years, keeping a track of when that is happening. So looking over a couple of years and seeing what time of year you're getting your allergies developing. Are they seasonal or are they occur all the time? So that's an important thing. Most people will develop their allergies at that time, and that'll be something that a parent is going to do for their kids or as part of their role of parenting. So if you're someone who's got an allergy during that October, November time in Melbourne, you can be pretty sure that it's going to be grass pollen induced hay fever. If you've got allergies which are not seasonal, that they occur all sorts of times of the year, it could easily be that you've got an allergy to something which is indoor, a fungus or cat dander or something like that. So being aware of what the allergen source is. Pollen, we've talked about seasons, plants having seasons for their reproductive cycle. And if you've got seasonal allergies, then it's very likely that you've got a pollen type of an allergy. And then it's figuring out what time of year you get your symptoms most, because it'll be the same time of year every year. There's treatment options, and if talking to doctors, and I'll let the doctors talk about what the treatment options are. The main way of mitigating those allergy symptoms is unfortunately by avoidance. That's about the only option for you. So if you know this is your time of year when you're going to get allergies, then the thing you want to do is stay out of the way of that pollen. That's going to be the most helpful thing to do. So certainly have your medications on hand, but avoidance is probably your best option. So that's staying indoors, keeping windows closed and so on. If you've got an air filter, having that air filter on.
Do air filters make a big difference in your experience, Ed?
They do trap pollen. If you've got inside windows and doors closed, then the air filters can make a big difference to whatever pollen is remaining in there. So it's going to, yes, it is going to lower the amount of stuff in the air in that room. That's what they're doing. So yes, they can be very helpful, used, you know, appropriately. How do you know when it's going to be a bad day for your allergies? The best thing, pollen counts like what we do. So in a town, in a city, which has got a pollen count, then look at the forecasts that they're producing. So there's lots of resources on the internet, which will do that. You can find what the pollen count in almost any city in the world. They don't do the actual counting of pollen. They just do the forecasting. So they never verify their forecast by going back and looking what the actual amount of pollen in the air was in that day. So services like ours, like Melbourne Pollen, do that forecasting, but we also verify our forecasting. So our forecasts are produced using real data. So that's an important difference. Use whatever service you find most useful. The ones which I think are most reliable are the ones which count and verify their forecasts.
All right. We'll have to do an Ask Me Anything episode, Ed, where we get listeners to send in their questions.
Okay.
We can pick your substantial gray matter for the answers.
All right. No worries at all, Sam.
That was great.